there's a big metal scene in Botswana. I think there's a whole also subset of goths in hot weather I want to explore. Because I've looked and seen pictures of folks in those scenes. And like everything else, they're dressed exactly the way goths in America are dressed. Their music is probably a little bit different. And I'm sure the outfits they have are a little bit different. I think whatever it is that's local to them. But again, at the core, everyone's wearing all black. And black nail polish and too many accessories.
On the menu in today's episode, cockroaches and haunted houses in the book choices of my guest, the author Leila Taylor, who is bringing Shirley Jackson and the Brazilian novelist Clarice Lispector to her desert island. We'll also connect the dots between Gothic narratives, Goth culture, and America's history of lynching and the slave trade.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth says the U.S. military campaign against alleged drug trafficking small boats that's killed nearly 90 people will continue. NPR's Amy Held reports Hegseth is doubling down on a controversial September strike on survivors clinging to the wreckage of a destroyed boat.
At a defense forum this weekend, Hegseth denied a Washington Post report that he had ordered everyone on board killed and even that he had watched the second strike.
A couple hours later, I was told, hey, there had to be a reattack because there were a couple folks that could still be in the fight.
It is unclear whether Republicans who control Congress are still in the fight with Democrats to investigate. Senator Mark Warner, the top Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, says not only should the public see the second strike video.
I want to see the execution order. I want to hear the communications between the admiral who made the second strike decision.
Hegseth was noncommittal about releasing the full video, saying, we'll see. Amy Held, NPR News.
Federal immigration raids continue. During an operation in Illinois yesterday, a federal agent was involved in a car crash in Elgin near Chicago. Hours later, police say there were reports of shots being fired in the area. They say no shots were fired, but federal agents deployed chemical irritants. 7 people were injured. State Senator Christina Castro was there when it happened. She said the operation was peaceful until the chemical irritants were deployed.
No due process. You know, people deserve the right to due process here. And here they are disturbing, again, my city, my hometown, where I've been born and raised. Striking fear amongst the Elginites that are here. And you know what? They just need to go home, go away.
A resident said the agents deployed the chemicals on the crowd that had gathered, including children. Americans' attention to the news has been dwindling for more than a decade, and no one is tuning out more than young people. That's according to a new study from Pew Research Center. NPR's Neda Ulaby has more on the story.
Pew says people between the ages of 18 and 29 are far more likely to say they feel scared or confused by the news, which they are far more likely to get from social media influencers like, for example, Hassan Piker on TikTok.
Ladies and gentlemen, what's going on?
Then from a national news organization like the New York Times, Fox News, or NPR. Most people over 65 say they follow the news all or most of the time. They are more likely to say it makes them feel informed. But only 15% of young people say they follow the news most of the time, and the vast majority say they get at least some of it from social media. About half say they trust that news from social media just as much as they trust information from a news organization. Neda Ulaby, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News in Washington. Early voting is underway in Miami for a new mayor. Election day is Tuesday. Although it's a local race, it's seen as an early test of the nation's political mood before next year's midterm elections. The Democrats are hoping to win the mayor's office for the first time in nearly 30 years. Sylvester Stallone, George Strait, the rock band Kiss, Gloria Gaynor, and English actor and singer Michael Crawford all receive Kennedy Center honors tonight, which celebrates achievements in the performing arts. NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports this year's Kennedy Center Honors will be different from past years.
A Kennedy Center Honor is traditionally for artists who've made a major contribution to the performing arts. It's considered to be a prestigious lifetime achievement award that in theory has cultural gravitas. Past winners include people like Quincy Jones, Gladys Knight, George Clooney, LL Cool J, and Alvin Ailey. In the past, the selection process took several months and involved a lot of different stakeholders. This year, it's really the President Trump show. He said he was 98% responsible for selecting the honorees. Something else that's different is that he will be hosting the event.
NPR's Elizabeth Blair. It's Christmas time in Bethlehem, which Christians revere as the birthplace of Jesus. A Christmas tree was lit yesterday for the first time in 2 years, previously canceled because of a ramp-up in military operations in the West Bank. Hundreds of people gathered in Manger Square for the ceremony. Officials are hoping the tourists will now return. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping those in need is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. This is NPR.
There's a big metal scene in Botswana. I think there's a whole also subset of goths in hot weather I want to explore. Because I've looked and seen pictures of folks in those scenes, and like everything else, they're dressed exactly the way goths in America are dressed. Their music is probably a little bit different. And I'm sure the outfits they have are a little bit different. I think whatever it is that's local to them, but again, at the core, everyone's wearing all black and black nail polish and too many accessories.
Hello and welcome to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. Hello. On this episode of Shelf Life, Haunted Houses, courtesy of Shirley Jackson, Meditations on a Cockroach in a seminal work by the Brazilian writer Clarice Lispector, and Ruminations on America's Dark Gothic Soul. Joining me is Leila Taylor, the author of Darkly, a brilliant investigation into the relationship between the Black experience in America and Gothic narratives that manages the tricky feat of juxtaposing the unspeakable history of lynching and the slave trade with ruminations on the author's love of goth fashion, graveyards, and Susie and the Banshees. Taylor's keen eye for ruined buildings and the spectral might be traced to her childhood in Detroit, where even in her relatively preserved neighborhood could be found abandoned lots and boarded up Victorian houses. But although she gravitated to goth, she was always aware that the mask never quite fit. Whiteness was never something I aspired to, but I considered myself a member of this tribe, she writes in Darkly. I'll admit, I sometimes felt a bit blackula-ish in their presence, a black version of a white story. Leila Taylor, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Not at all. Leila, we're going to be talking a lot about the Gothic today, a subject on which you're an expert, having written a book on your own love affair with Goth and its relationship to Black history in America. So I wonder if you might just start by explaining the difference or the distinction between goth as a sort of pop cultural phenomenon as opposed to the gothic.
Sure. So goth is sort of a cousin. It's sort of a subset of gothic. Goth, put it simply, is a music genre and the fashion and subculture that arose from that culture, which I think most people agree started with like around 1979 with Joy Division and kind of solidified in terms of its style and look with Susie and the Banshees and The Cure, Bauhaus, you know, with Bela Lugosi's Dead, the kind of quintessential, I think, goth song. So goth is sort of really specific, but gothic is bigger. Gothic is broader. It's a descriptor. It's a type, it's a tone, it's something that can be ascribed to just about anything. There's a new book out by Roger Lunkhurst who describes the Gothic as a collection of traveling tropes, which I love. It's a very liquid term. It's applied to architecture and literature and art. So the Gothic is much broader. It's a way of describing what something is like.
And of course, we think of goth culture, or the subgenre of goth culture, as a very white thing, predominantly. I mean, it's, I think you say in the book, although goths wear black, they look like they've got tuberculosis, it's extremely white, pale makeup. A lot of them wear, I'm thinking of Susie Sue from Susie and the Banshees in particular. I have to ask, what's a woman like you who grew up in Detroit doing flirting with goth culture?
Well, you know, I was always a creepy kid. Like, I always liked weird, dark things. I liked, things that had to do with magic or the occult. Mm-hmm. I remember being in kindergarten and living not too far away from a graveyard. And me and my little friends would go to the graveyard. And there was a hole, I guess like a hole they were preparing for someone. And we would make mud pies out of the dirt from like the open grave. And we would play like funeral where one of us would pretend to be dead and we would cry over the other person. And, you know, I had my, you know, requisite obsession with vampires. And then I would say around 13, I discovered Susie and the Banshees and Anne Rice, like at the same time. And that just gelled. That was just like, that's it. That this is what I am, whatever this is. So the things that I liked, they all fell into this category. They all kind of fell into this gothic category. So it was really sort of discovering that there were other people in the world who liked what I liked. I mean, like I said, I was like 13. It's not like I was going to clubs, you know, but Detroit had an amazing music scene.
Right.
And they had amazing radio. So I discovered the music first. And then go got like Star Hits magazine or Smash Hits. And there was like the local like punk record store or whatever. And you had like the t-shirts and the buttons and things like that. Cause there's no Hot Topic and there's no internet. So it was all things you just kind of had to discover on your own. And it was kind of more an expression of my own personality than it was picking out a subculture and saying, I want to join this group. It was just me finding all the weird things in the world that I liked that fit my weirdness.
You tell a story in Darkly of your father coming into your bedroom when you're a 13-year-old girl or maybe a little older in Detroit and looking at all the posters on your wall of these sort of white English bands, Bauhaus, The Cure, etc. And then among that wall of posters, there's one image of a black person, and your father sort of jokes or smirks, oh, that's the token black person, is it? And you feel this sort of moment of shame. I think you quickly go out and buy a Terence Trent D'Arby poster to add to your collection.
I did, purely out of guilt. Yeah, I was mortified. Because it also made me feel like, is he right? Is there something about this? Is there something about me that's not as black as I'm supposed to be, whatever that's supposed to mean? Was my blackness not real or something? Because I liked all of these so-called white bands with white music or whatever. And I say so-called because, you know, of course there are black people making punk and post-punk all along. And there are black people who are fans of this music all along. It's just that they weren't seen that much. But yeah, I felt this weird bit of guilt that I was somehow, I don't know, going against my people or going against my race. And this little twinge of, do I want to be white? Is that what he's suggesting? Do I subconsciously want that? And so I got the Terence Trent D'Arby poster and put that up. And I was like, there you go. And then, but that didn't last long. That was me having this weird moment of doubt that would happen every now and then when my blackness was questioned for liking something different or dressing in a different way, you know, and it took a while to realize that that's just crap. But it was, I remember being absolutely sort of scarred by that, you know, offhand comment about me being a token black person or liking a token black person.
I mean, there is in the book, you do you do have a very serious point to make about this, which is that, and I'm paraphrasing here, but essentially one of the reasons that a subgenre like Gothic is so white is because for Black people in America, there's little space for whimsy. Like, life doesn't afford the opportunity to spend a decent, you know, percentage of their lives indulging in silliness. That this is one of the reasons why movements like Goth have been seen with suspicion by other Black people, because they sort of represent something that they can ill afford to participate in.
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately the Gothic is romanticism, sort of a kind of dark romanticism. And there is something whimsical about it. There is something dreamy about it. And as a Black person in America, being dreamy can be dangerous. You know, we become built in with this awareness, with this skepticism that's warranted. That's a survival technique of always kind of being watchful and always knowing, you know, always knowing the other side of things, always knowing the dark reality behind things, because not being in reality and not being aware can cost you your life. I mean, that's why there were all of these websites for a while and hashtags about Black joy that were just focused on Black people having fun, being at a picnic or doing silly things at home, or just purely being human and being silly and being joyful, because it's something that's so rarely seen in our culture. I think there's a reason also why Black people historically, at least in America, are reluctant to go into therapy. I think that there is a need to be in control. And things like Goth or any of these subcultures where it's pure frivolity, you know, and that's what I've called the privilege of frivolity. I mean, if you're walking around in a velvet cloak and a top hat in the summertime, that's pretty, you know, that's whimsical. That's not serious. That is someone who is dreamy. That's someone who is living in a romantic world, you know?
Right. I'm Aaron Hicklin. This is Shelf Life. And my guest today is Leila Taylor, the author of Darkly. What were the origins for you of writing Darkly? Because it's this, you know, very impressive synthesis of, on the one hand, your personal story, your relationship to goth music, to goth as a subgenre, but then sort of moving out from that and looking at this 400-year history of American violence, violence against Black bodies in particular, and how these two things relate, gothic narratives and violence in the American story are intertwined. What was the sort of the eureka moment for you when you understood that there was a book in this idea?
Yeah, I started off wanting to do a book about Black folks in the goth scene. And as I was, you know, starting my writing and starting the research, I realized, one, I'm not a sociologist. So doing a kind of ethnographic study of a subculture wasn't really my thing. Also just got kind of boring. Because the thing with a subculture is that everyone's kind of doing the same thing, regardless of what your race, religion, gender, ethnicity, whatever it is. Y'all like the same kind of music. You dress the same way. You know, you like the same kind of stuff. So I saw this t-shirt, and it said, "So goth I was born Black." And at first I was like, oh, that's funny, you know. But and thinking about it, I was like, what does that actually mean? Like, what is inherently goth about being Black? And I started thinking more about what the gothicness of Blackness and less about just goths, right? And I listened to Strange Fruit and I was like, this is the most goth song I've ever heard. And then I started thinking about Toni Morrison's Beloved. And I was like, this is a gothic novel. This is a gothic horror story, you know, and how both of those things are based on true events, based on real events that happen to real people. Once you go down that route, then it just became just this sort of never ending rabbit hole of seeing the connections between the various pieces of art, various kinds of music that comes out of Black culture, came from Black voices, that had its connection to the violence of white supremacy and the violence of what Black people have been through, and how we've taken that trauma, we've taken that anger and that sorrow from 400 years of oppression and are able to metabolize it into something that's beautiful and interesting and metabolize it into art. And I think that's what the Gothic does. It's about the materialization of particularly melancholy and fear, those two things that human beings usually try desperately to avoid in their lives. And the Gothic stares straight at it. And it's a way of dealing with trauma. Horror has always been a way of dealing with anxieties and trauma. It's a way of gaining power over it. You know, when you can take something and turn it into something that's your own. That's a powerful statement. That's a powerful thing to do. So I think when I started, as I got sort of less specific to just the Gothic and got bigger and bigger and bigger, it went from, you know, a t-shirt to all of America really quickly.
There's another anecdote in Darkly where you go on a pilgrimage, ostensibly to England, to stand at the gravesite of Ian Curtis from Joy Division and stand on the moors and basically embrace your gothness. You make it sound like it was sort of plain sailing, but what did you learn about yourself once you were in that scene, in that very white scene, as you admit?
I think, and again, I was fortunate in that I was pre-internet and pre-Hot Topic, because I didn't have any really preconceived notions of what I was supposed to look like. But I did know that I would go into these spaces or go to a club or go to a show. I was mostly going to concerts. I was going to more concerts than I was like clubs. But the ability to achieve paleness was something I was very envious of. And I remember there was a discussion on makeup, and specifically about Black women and goth makeup. And the distinction between, it's not about wanting to look white, it's about wanting to look dead. And those are two different things. It was easier dressing. It was easier for me to dress in all Black and wear like rings on every finger and paint my nails Black and all that kind of stuff. And I was fortunate in that my friends, who are also white, I didn't really feel that much of an outsider in these situations. I didn't feel like I was not wanted. I think whatever, and this is also again Detroit, which is, there's a lot of different kinds of people. There's a lot of weird people in Detroit. It wasn't like I was going into a situation where it was majority white all the time. The school I went to was very mixed, a lot of Black people. The neighborhood I lived in was all Black, you know, so I was used to being in an environment where Black people were the majority, you know. So I didn't feel necessarily ostracized or outside of the group in that way. So I think I was fortunate. I was fortunate in that. And it wasn't really until I got a little bit older when we moved to Cincinnati, Ohio, which was very segregated. It was a very segregated school where there were Black folks were on one side and white folks were there on the other. And that's when I felt like I didn't fit in. That's when I started feeling that I was the weird one. Because it was so separate, you know. When you're one Black weirdo amongst a whole bunch of other Black weirdos, who cares? But when you're the one Black weirdo amongst a sea of white weirdos, it makes your weirdo-ness even stronger. It's that being marginalized within a marginalized group. You feel that kind of, that one step removed. So it really wasn't until I think I got older and found myself in much more segregated spaces that I started to feel like, where is everybody? Where are all the Black folks? I know I'm not the only one. I know I'm not the only one. Where is everybody?
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and my guest today is Leela Taylor, author of Darkly, Black History and America's Gothic Soul. I've noticed that there's been a lot of talk in 2022 of goths. I looked at a headline in Vogue that announced that 2022 was Goth Girl Summer, with images of Lizzo and Bella Hadid channeling Morticia Adams at the Met Ball. And we've also got Jenna Ortega playing Wednesday Adams in Tim Burton's new Netflix series, Wednesday. Kourtney Kardashian had a sort of gothic transformation this year at a wedding, no less. So we seem to be in a moment when maybe goth is transcendent.
There are always moments. There are these, I feel like every so often, maybe it's every 6 months or so, an article comes out declaring goth fashion as being in again. It just comes and goes in waves. And usually it's because someone famous wore all black once. And they're like, oh, now they're goth. And then they just see every other celebrity or famous person who has dressed all in black, and then it's Black Goth Girl Summer. Wednesday Adams, yes. She's the only one in that group of people that's legit and all of that. I mean, the interesting thing about goth is that it's a subculture that does not die. It really just keeps going and going and morphing and changing and adapting to the culture and to the styles. It just keeps kind of coming back and back. So there's moments where everyone sort of discovers it all of a sudden. I think what's more interesting is the rise of Black horror. So there's been this burst of creativity around horror made by Black people, kind of directed towards Black people, that is a bit new and that feels fresh. I mean, there's been Black people making and doing horror all along, but the commercial success of things like Get Out is kind of putting things on another level. So when I said I was a kid, I didn't have any references. I didn't have any visual clues or idols to look at and say, oh, that's what it looks like to be Black goth. Oh, these are the references I can pull from. And now, I think between, you know, music and film and fashion and the web, there's so many sources that people can pull from and look at and interpret the gothic in their own way that also expresses their own Blackness, you know? I think there's just more resources than there was before, than when I was young, you know?
So you were reading Anne Rice at 13 and listening to Susie Sue. Were you also watching horror movies at that age?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I would say probably the biggest movie in my life at that point was The Hunger, which is also probably the most goth movie ever. David Bowie, Catherine Deneuve, Susan Sarandon. First of all, David Bowie as a vampire, that alone should just satisfy everyone. I was obsessed with that movie. And I remember us going through quite a journey to some suburban video store to get a copy of this thing. It was a long and stressful journey to get this copy of The Hunger.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm talking to Leila Taylor, the author of Darkly. We'll be back after this.
Hey, it's Jason Dole letting you know how you can help nourish our neighbors. More families are struggling to put food on the table. Local food pantries are stepping up, but they need help. You can donate non-perishable food, personal care items, or baby supplies, or volunteer to assist with distribution. It can make a real difference. Learn more at WJFFradio.org to help make sure everyone in our community has enough to eat. Radio Catskill, keeping our neighbors connected.
I'm Laura Flanders. Join me Monday evenings at 7 on Radio Catskill for Laura Flanders and Friends. It's the show where the people who say it can't be done take a backseat to the people who are doing it. Then stay with us for 3 more Powerhouse Talk programs back to back. Sabrina Artel's Trailer Talk at 7:30, The Janice Adams Show at 8, and La Voz en Breve with Mariel Fiore at 9. Monday evenings, starting at 7, only on Radio Catskill.
Hello, you're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and my guest today is Leila Taylor, the author of Darkly. We're talking about two of her favorite books. Leila, you admit in Darkly to loving haunted house narratives, and you've picked one of the most famous for your first book choice today, Shirley Jackson's 1959 Gothic horror, The Haunting of Hill House. Jackson, of course, is famous for her short story, The Lottery, which is often identified as the greatest American short story ever written. It ran in The New Yorker in 1948, eliciting a torrent of outrage from readers and cancelled subscriptions. The Haunting of Hill House was published a decade later in 1959. It tells the story of four people who travel to Hill House to participate in an experiment designed to ascertain the existence of the paranormal. The four are Dr. Montague, an investigator of the supernatural, Eleanor Vance, who has been in a kind of stasis since her father died when she was a child, leaving her to care for her invalid mother, Theodora, a kind of ethereal artist, and Luke Sanderson, the heir to Hill House. There are also a couple of rather comic caretakers of the house who refused to stay there at night. And later on, we get Dr. Montague's wife, who's a sort of comic figure in her own right. Leila, Shirley Jackson admitted to believing in ghosts. Do you?
I want to believe. It depends. When the closer it gets to Halloween, I believe more and more until, you know, I do believe that we linger somehow. I don't know how, I don't know in what form, but I do think that sometimes the past overlaps into the present in some ways that we don't understand. And I like the idea of that kind of time travel that ghosts and hauntings imply, you know, like as if we're getting a little bit of a glimpse into something that happened before. And I think I like that idea more than the soul of the person who died staying, you know, like they just can't move on. I like the idea that we're getting a little bit of an impression of something that happened that kind of stuck in the residue of the past is left over. So, I do think that objects can absorb energies. I know that sounds very like woo-woo, but I do think there's something in the power of emotions and the power of personality and the power of our minds and our traumas and our, you know, our joys that can stick somehow. And I think maybe that's what a haunting is, or that's what ghosts are. I'm not sure, but I say yes with a question mark.
That question mark is interesting. I mean, it's interesting you say woo-woo too, because I think Shirley Jackson understood that people who believe in ghosts, much like people who believe in UFOs, are slightly suspect. She has Dr. Montague, who's leading this investigation after all, and clearly believes in the paranormal. Even he can't find the courage to tell his colleagues that he believes in paranormal activities. He tells them he's on a camping trip, which I thought was sort of really smart of Jackson. And the book is full of that kind of knowingness. When did you first encounter this book, and how did you learn about Shirley Jackson?
Oh, man, I think I probably read it. I mean, I want to say maybe high school or something. I mean, I think I read it a long time ago, and it really wasn't until much, much later that I kind of rediscovered it again. And again, I don't exactly remember when or how or why. It could have been I was in a bookstore and I was like, oh yeah, I remember that. And then, and of course I had read The Lottery, and We've Always Lived in the Castle. And I love her way of getting into the minds of women, the interiority of her characters. And I love the kind of brashness of it. And I love that it's not sweet. And I love that her books are disturbing and they're creepy and they stick with you. And I love the edge. I love the edge of her writing. And but mostly I love her characters. I love Eleanor, and I think I identify with her in a lot of ways. And I think that's why I love this book particularly, because I felt like there was a lot in that character that I could identify with. And there's a dreaminess of her and sort of constantly waiting for something to happen, so to speak, or waiting for her life to begin. And this fantasizing of what that life could be like, this living in her head. This is the character who is in her head all of the time. Mm. And there's something about that that I tie with.
It's interesting because she arrives at Hill House and finds it vile, is the word she uses. She really dislikes the place. But at some point during the course of this narrative, her attitude shifts 180 and she can't bear to think of leaving the house. What do you think is happening in Eleanor's mind, in Eleanor's brain, that changes that perception of Hill House? Is it the house or is it Eleanor?
I think it's both. And I think that's one of the things that I think people go back and forth is sort of Eleanor haunting the house or is the house haunting her? I think the dynamic between her and the group changes because she starts off, the house is vile. It's disturbing. She hates it. She wants to get out of there. And in the beginning, she's kind of fitting in with the group. She's charming. She's making jokes. She's one of them. She's one of the group. And as the shift from her disliking the house or hating the house to really kind of wanting to be a part of the house, that also happens when she's more and more distant from the group. The group starts to see her as being strange or sick or different and things like that. So she goes from being part of this society and part of this kind of normal social activity and hating the scary house, like you're supposed to hate the scary house, to I guess I want to say becoming less interior. I think all of the fantasies that were in her head start kind of creeping out to the outside and she becomes more close to the, she becomes closer to the house than she does to the people, and the people become the scary things, the ones who are dangerous, the ones to mistrust. I like the idea of her being sort of better friends with the house in the end of the day than these characters.
It's interesting because she becomes increasingly violent in her thoughts about the others as the story progresses. So she starts off rather loving Theodora, but towards the end, she says, I would like to hit her with a stick, looking down at her head, resting beside her chair. I'd like to batter her with rocks. What did you make of that push and pull of her feelings for Theodora? I found those almost more disturbing than anything else in the book.
Yeah, I love it because it feels very real to me. I mean, Theodora is someone who, complete opposite of her. It's someone who's open, who seems to have a very exciting life, an exciting social life, beautiful and fashionable and all of that. So at the beginning, I can see her looking at Theodora and going, you know, oh, this is everything that I wish I was, and her admiring her. But that can only last so long. The longer you get to know someone, the surface goes away, and it's not just about how they dress and about how charming they're talking, but you start seeing them as a real person. And Theodora starts getting a little mean to her as well. So I think the real Eleanor starts coming out where she's angry. And people get angry. And they think of horrible things when they're angry at someone. So I love the fact that Jackson puts that in paper. You know, that it's disturbing in that you're seeing or hearing someone or reading about someone who seems so timid and meek and powerless have such violent feelings. But at that time, I'm like, yes, Eleanor, get mad, get violent.
In a sense, it's sort of what Shirley Jackson was often criticized for, which is actually understanding the nature of being human, that people could be very capable of depraved thoughts and actually, in a case of the lottery, depraved actions, right? And that was the thing people didn't want to see. They didn't want to read. So it kind of, in her lifetime, I think, often stigmatized her writing. But actually, it's the thing that holds up more than anything now because it's kind of the truest thing she wrote is that people are complicated and capable of anger and violence as much as they're capable of generosity and kindness.
Yeah, yeah.
The other character here, of course, is the house. It's a little like a funfair house in some ways. So we have this house where no one can ever find their way around it. Every time they go in one direction, they find they've gone in a completely different direction. Doors close after they've propped them open. It makes sounds at night. There are parts of the house which are sort of sub-zero temperatures, or one part of the house. It's a character in its own right.
First, I love the description that she makes of the sick house, of a house that's sick, which I think is a beautiful way of putting that. I love the way that the doctor tries to rationalize everything. Like, he's discovered the reason. The reason being that everything is off. All of the angles are slightly off in the entire house in some way. So everyone's inner ears are all sort of in a dizzying state because their equilibrium is off. I like the fact that there's an attempt to try to scientifically rationalize the weird vibes that people get from this place. But I also like the idea of this entity, this thing that's housing people, as being inherently ill in some way. And I don't know, maybe Eleanor catches it. Maybe whatever sickness the house has is what Eleanor is catching. But the way that she describes the house and the detail that she describes the house is so specific. It really feels like you're walking through that space and you can identify this. And when you're getting lost the way they get lost, there are times when I would kind of go back and say, like, wait, where's the dining room? Wait, they went down that hallway and like, where are they now? And I'm trying in my head to kind of map the space and it not really working that well. So I'm a little bit lost, the way the characters are a little bit lost. I think she does a brilliant job in giving this building a personality.
In Darkly, you make the point that most horror stories begin with a grain of truth, I think is the words you use. What do we know of the background to the writing of this novel, The Haunting of Hill House? What do we know about Shirley Jackson and the sort of origins of this story?
One of the things I like about Shirley Jackson is she's a little bit Eleanor and a little bit Theodora, and that she was, a popular person. She was married to a critic and they had children and they had a very sort of boisterous home and there were all sorts of parties and guests and things like that. But at the same time, she was also kind of critical of domesticity and the kind of trap of domesticity that women were put in, which is a lot of her female characters seem to be restless in that way or questioning in that way. But I don't really know the backstory behind the writing of this particular book.
She died relatively young at the age of 48. At a very moment when she was kind of in the full flush of her writing. She'd not long written The Haunting of Hill House, and then she'd just published We Shall Always Live in the Castle.
It's interesting because also Spectre died relatively young as well in comparison. I think she ended up getting, I don't know if she was addicted to painkillers, but she was on a lot of painkillers. And her health was deteriorating, and she died too soon.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and my guest today is Leila Taylor, the author of Darkly, Black History and America's Gothic Soul. Leila, the passion, according to G.H., is almost abstract in style. It's written by Clarice Lispector, the Brazilian writer, although she was born in Ukraine. It's very stream of conscience monologue in which a woman enters the room of a recently departed maid and crushes a roach in the hinge of a wardrobe door. Other than that, there is really no plot. The book is about transformation. It's about fear. It's about breaking with convention. It's a meditation on the essential meaninglessness of life. I hesitate to say that some readers might find it pretentious, but reading it can be hard work. It's dense. I wonder if you would recommend this book to a reader who hadn't encountered her work before.
I will say it's pretentious. I have no problem with saying that it's kind of pretentious. It's, I mean, this is the first book of, this is how I was introduced to Clarice Lispector. It's a trip. And I mean that in the literal kind of drug-related mystical experience. I love it in that it just flows. This stream of conscious rambling from one point to another point to another point, where she starts off in this room. In this very simple situation, she's in a room, there's a cabinet, and she closes a roach on it, and it's gross, and it just sends her into this, like, transcendental mystic experience where she's, like, hallucinating through space and time, right? And it just kind of goes on and on and on. And every once in a while, there's a little recollection about something in her real life. She remembers a situation where she was looking for an abortion, or she'll remembers like going to a dinner party and wearing a dress. So every once in a while, she comes back to Earth a little bit, or she realizes that she's sweating a lot because she's stuck in this room. But I think the reason why I chose this book, Hill House, I wish there was a merger of Eleanor's account of Hill House with Clarice Lispector's subconscious rambling. Like, I want a book that just stays in Eleanor's mind the entire time. And that's what this book, that's what The Passion According to Geisha is. It's all in her head. It's all in her mind. And it's one thought after another, after another. And I think when I was reading it, I just had this kind of gleeful feeling like, where am I? This is bonkers. And I just kind of loved it. And it made me want to write a book like it. I don't know if I ever will, but it makes me want to do what she did, which is just actually sit down and write one thought after the other, and see how far I can go, see how lost I can get into that process. Because a lot of that, actually both of these books, is a lot about the loss of identity or loss of self, a lot of ego death in The Passion, where she's kind of all about dissolving into the state of nothingness, you know, where Eleanor is sort of dissolving into the state of Hill House. I would say it's a little bit like, maybe like a David Lynch movie. You just have to accept it. Don't try to analyze it. Don't try to think about it too much. Just go along for the ride. And you're right, there really isn't a plot. There is a climax. There is sort of an action that happens that she builds up to doing. But it's not a actual traditional beginning, middle, end of a story that one would have. But it's a trip. It's if you kind of just let your mind go a little bit and go with it.
I mean, as someone who has an affinity for horror, did you see some of that in this book?
Oh, everything with the roach. All of the roach stuff is absolutely horrific to me. But also the idea of sort of being trapped in your own mind. Like, she could get up and leave that room anytime she wanted to, really. But she was stuck. She was stuck in this situation in which, I don't know, she was sort of lost in her own thoughts in a way that felt out of her control. You know, which is why I kind of equate it with something like a drug trip. It's like, this wasn't something that she intended. She didn't decide to stay stuck behind this cabinet staring at a roach for an entire day. But that's what happened to her, you know. I just get shivers thinking about it. It's so gross.
Yeah, I think it's almost encyclopedic the way she can reel off all these facts about roaches, yeah. That they can live for a month without food and water. They can be frozen and still come back to life. I think she sort of describes them both as of the past and also very much present in this way that they have association with the dinosaur age.
Very primordial and all of that.
It has fiercely loyal readers. I had a look on Goodreads, and like, there is such a tumult of passion for this book. And there was a very funny little anecdote from her translator that I stumbled on, translator Aydra Novi. She wrote, "A friend in Brazil told me of a young woman in Rio who had read Clarice Lispector obsessively and was convinced, as I and legions of other Clarice devotees have been, that she and Clarice Lispector would have a life-changing connection if they met in person. She managed to get in touch with the writer, who kindly agreed to meet her. When the young woman arrived, Clarice sat and stared at her and said nothing until the woman finally fled the apartment." I so often want to meet my literary heroes, but that was definitely a corrective. Would you like to meet Clarice Lispector?
Not now. Oh, God. No, I think if she was alive, then, you know, I would be terrified. I think I would be terrified to meet her. I mean, she was also incredibly glamorous. You know, you see photos of her and, like, you know, yeah, she was a force. So I think I think it would be terrifying to sit across a table from Clarice Lispector and just have her staring at you and not say anything. That would just be terrifying.
And how about Shirley Jackson?
I can see having a bourbon with her.
Yeah.
I can see having a conversation with her. She feels, I think she's no nonsense and witty and incredibly smart, but also a little more human. I think she feels a little more of this earth than maybe a Spectre does.
Yeah, she certainly enjoyed her bourbon and her steaks and
yeah,
whatever else might land on her plate at dinner time. She had an appetite. I wonder if part of the attraction of both these writers for you is also their circumstances. They were both women writers in mid-century in Brazil and in the United States, who were at the same time mothers and wives and married and had their hands very much full. But they managed to write these extraordinary books, multiple novels and short stories. In both cases, they were master of the short story. At a time when it was largely assumed that if you were a woman, it was very hard to find the time to write if you had children. And they managed that. They sort of, in a sense, punched through that ceiling. Was that something that spoke to you as a writer and as a woman writer?
Yeah, I think so. They also both wrote articles, like kind of domestic, like women's life articles for like various journals and things like that as like side gigs,
yeah,
or whatever.
Yeah.
So they both kind of supplemented their real writing with the kind of writing that you would expect from like Ladies' Home Journal, you know, and she, you know, Jackson would write these funny like stories about her life or whatever. And so I think that combination of having to be one kind of a woman in some capacity, being a mother, being a wife, being a hostess, being, you know, someone of the home, of the house, that kind of domestic life, with having just an immense imagination, with having the depth of mind and imagination and talent to put that imagination on paper in evocative ways. I think those two things existing in one person is something that a lot of people feel, and I think probably a lot of women feel. We're kind of having to be multiple people at the same time, depending on the audience, depending on who you're talking to. And I admire the fact that both of these women just did it and did it well. For the times that I think they died maybe like a year, like maybe 10 years apart. They're kind of, I would say they're kind of contemporaries. Yeah.
I think Clarice Lispector, in contrast to Shirley Jackson, came from very humble beginnings. She was an orphan by the age of 20. Her mother, I think, died of injuries she'd sustained in leaving Ukraine, where they had dealt with all sorts of trauma. But I found that, sort of moving context for the success she found in life as a writer, and the fact that she was able to make a life for herself after that.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Anyone who can overcome those kind of traumas and those kind of hardships with their imagination and their talent intact. Because it's one thing to feel these things. It's one thing to experience these things, but then be able to keep your mind intact to whatever degree that is and put things on paper in a way that's so sort of magical is admirable. Because most people just sort of survive. Right. Most people are just sort of getting from day to day in whatever way that is, whether you're going through terrific hardship or just living a relatively comfortable life. And I think it takes a lot of guts to take that extra step and go a little bit deeper and put a lot of yourself on paper for the entire world to look at.
There's a line in the book where the character G.H. says or suggests that to be fully alive is in part to live in a kind of hell. It hurts to live in the universe. Do you share that view?
Yeah. And I keep going back to this idea of the Gothic being about experiencing everything, that full spectrum. And I don't trust people who are happy all of the time. I find it very suspect of people who sort of don't show that part of themselves or keep all of that part of themselves inside. I think living a full life means getting to the dark side. You know, anyone who's been in therapy, it's not fun. It's not as fun experiencing when you have to dig deep inside of yourself and things like that. But the end result is worth it. This reminds me, what you just said reminded me of the very first line of Hill House, which I underline, and I love this line so much, if you don't mind if I read it.
Please.
No live organism can continue for long to exist sanely under conditions of absolute reality. I love that. I was like, yeah, no, you can't. If you just stuck to what's actually in front of you in reality all the time and pretended like there was nothing else and demanded that there was nothing else, I think you'd go nuts. That's why you need whimsy. That's why you need romanticism and fantasy and whimsy. Because just plain old reality sucks. Sorry. Well, to be a downer.
I don't think we can part without getting a quick update on where you are with your writing now. You've published one nonfiction book, Darkly. Are you working on a novel?
I started working on a novel and realized that I am not very good at making up stuff. And I really love doing nonfiction. So I am working on another nonfiction book. But this one is also about horror. But speaking of haunted houses, it's about horror and architecture and the home and our ideas of what the home means and how horror kind of perverts and subverts our ideas of what makes the comfortable idea of home that we have, whatever that is, how it gets torn apart and be put together in horror.
Leela Taylor, thank you so much for joining me on Shelf Life today. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It was fun.
We've been talking about The Haunting of Hill House by Shirley Jackson and The Passion, according to G.H., by Clarice Lispector, both published by Penguin Random House. Darkly, Black History in America's Gothic Soul by Leela Taylor is published by Repeater Books. You can find copies of all three titles at bookstores like One Grand Books. My thanks as always to my producer, Ilya Maritz, and sound engineer and composer, Tim Wood. And if you like the show, you can find plenty more on Apple and Spotify with guests such as Alan Cumming, John Waters, Joyce Maynard, Kevin Barry, and Sir David Hare. While you're there, help us reach more people by giving us a 5-star rating.
Sullivan County's social host law, Jared's Law, makes it illegal for anyone 18 or older to provide alcohol or cannabis to minors. Named for a local teen killed in a drunk driving accident, Jared's Law ensures that adults are held accountable, with penalties including fines and even jail time. Parents and guardians are still the number one deterrent to underage substance use, and Jared's Law helps keep our kids safe. Paid for by Catholic Charities.
Looking for things to do? Check out Radio Catskill's community calendar. Find out what's happening or submit your own event. The community calendar at wjffradio.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville. From river to river, mountain to mountain, we are Radio Catskill.